Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of Review Less and a good friend of Juranov. And welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it on your iPod, iPad, computer, whatever device you have, and hit play. Today we have a real interesting show, which I can always say truthfully when Craig Ball's on the show. Recently I emailed Craig to ask him for his advice on working with some Gmail and third-party hosted email solutions for advice with a client I was working with, and Craig emailed me. He was in France drinking some wine, which shows that Craig is truly smarter than all of us in eDiscovery. In fact, the time before we did a different podcast, Craig was in Hong Kong. So while many of us are struggling with building the perfect model of search retrieval, review, and defensibility, and throwing in the challenges of project management on top of that, where there are, you know, the normal politics of differing economics and interests between the participants and how cases are handled, Craig's oftentimes in another country having fun. So this is what keeps me up at night. I want to be more like you, Craig, and less like me. But anyway, Craig was extremely helpful, as he always is, to my requests, and despite the many time zones that separate us, so I suggested that when he gets back, we do a show on this topic. For those of you who don't know Craig, he's a prolific contributor in the continuing legal and professional education space, offering programs throughout the United States. I estimate you've done, what, 700 or 800 of these presentations and papers at this point, Craig. Are you still keeping track?
No, you're right. It's upwards of 700, 750 at this point.
Okay. And his articles on forensic technology and electronic discovery frequently appear in the national media, including American Bar Association, ALTA, American Lawyer Media Print, and online publications. Many people know his column in Law Technology News called Ball in Your Court, which has won many, many awards. He's frequently been on ESI Bytes with me, and I always like having Craig back. Always a fun time talking to him, very knowledgeable, and Craig's always willing to take a principled stand on any issue that he knows something about, which is refreshing in the e-discovery field. So, Craig, thank you again for joining us here on the show. And we're going to talk about accessing cloud-based ESI for litigation. So let's start. Let's talk about reality, which is all the cloud-based tools we use to communicate and run our lives. And for most of us who are in our 40s, this is substantially still email. So what are some effective strategies parties can use to put litigation holds in place with third-party email, like Gmail, MSN, Ymail, or other offerings?
Well, all I can say, Carl, is I can still remember my 40s. I can't actually join you in the 40s any longer.
Okay, fair enough.
But as I say, I still haven't lost sight of them. But let's start with your question of what to do with online email, with webmail. And you really need to start that approach, Carl, by figuring out the scope of what we need to put on hold, the risks of loss to that information, and the tools and techniques we're planning to use to search the collection when and if that time comes. With webmail, as with most cloud-based data, someone else has physical dominion over the media that stores the data. So you no longer have the luxury we once had to say, hey, let's just image a drive or a couple of drives or pull a tape from the rotation. Let's grab the EDB. Let's grab the local PSTs and, you know, pat ourselves on the back that we've now set everything in stone. Instead, all you have is a right of access, typically via the internet, and typically the ability, often with some effort, to reclaim your data, to what I call repatriate your data, by downloading it to some compatible form of local storage. And in many cases, this will be the more familiar form of Microsoft Outlook. Now, Rule 34 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure that governs discovery and electronic discovery obliges litigants to produce responsive, non-privileged information in their possession, custody, or control. And this right of access is the right of control. So maintaining an effective legal hold entails depriving those who have the power or the motive to discard or alter data of their ability to do so. Now, historically, Carl, companies have relied upon the diligence and good faith of their employees to ensure evidence isn't lost. I mean, that's the the game. We'll send out a notice to all of our employees saying, now don't destroy the information that proves that you were a sexist, chauvinist pig or whatever it may be. But the many instances that where that's proved to be putting the foxes in charge of the hen house are starting to help lawyers appreciate that custodial preservation by itself is unreliable at best and irresponsible at worst. Now, when I say by itself, I want to be clear. I'm not saying that custodial preservation is off the table, by no means. You still have to tell people to find and preserve responsive data. You still have to tap into that intellectual capital you have of the subject matter experts in the data. No one should know more about their data than the custodians of the data. But you shouldn't rely upon that alone. As President Reagan used to say, trust everyone, but cut the cards. And the cutting the cards here is the use of certain objective methods to guard against the loss or destruction, the failure to take action of your various employees. Okay, so with that said, what we've got to do is act to ensure that the data isn't going anywhere. Now, that can include restricting the ability of those with an incentive to destroy or alter the data to do so, or that you secure a sufficient, usable, or reasonably usable replica of the data. So the calculus then becomes, Carl, what do we have? Where is it? What do we need to preserve? What are the risks of loss? And how can we secure the data against those risks? Then add one more. In what form should we hold the data so that it retains the metadata and the functionality that we need and that will ensure it compatibly works with our search tools and, while we're at it, will comply with the form in which our opponents are seeking production?
Okay. So, you know, are there specific challenges that you see with these forms of communication to retrieve them? I mean, are all these third parties set up the same to basically live in that rural world and give you that right of access? Or?
Oh, they aren't. And I see some really big challenges, actually. Take Gmail. Now, Gmail is something that I've used and loved for about 7 years. I've got about 11.5 gigabytes of data stored with Google, and the majority of that are my messaging and attachments over these years. Even if I were to try to repatriate that data, to bring it home, it's going to take me some time to download that volume of information through that tiny soda straw we laughingly call high-speed internet today. Now, multiply that volume, for just me, by the number of custodians subject to an enterprise hold, and you get a sense of how silly this is. We're putting information into the cloud, and then we're pulling it back to ourselves and creating a copy, an inconsistent copy, of the information. So as I wrote in an article that was published today about cloud computing, if the fearsome twins of e-discovery are reckless replication and huge volume, then all we're doing is adding to the problem by the approach we're taking of always making a copy of the information for purposes of preservation and analysis.
Is this a new form of TIFF, Craig? I know you're a big fan of TIFFing.
Well, yes, I'm usually so shy about my opinions, Carl. I'm so glad you saw through me on that one. But let me move on and say that you know, volume and the challenge of sucking the data down is not the biggest issue. Because when I bring that data home, finally, it's got to go into some sort of mail container, and it's got to be in a usable format. Now, the way Google, for example, presents my messaging to me online is in elegant threads, and there are a variety of unique organizational features that make Google and Gmail such a useful tool. But these features have no complete corollary in the offline applications like Microsoft Outlook or Lotus Notes. I mean, the two things are different, and as much as they keep playing catch-up, copying each little leap forward one makes, and often the leap forward is going to be on the online tool before the offline tool, obviously, they are not fully compatible. So I'm going to have to accept some compromises in terms of the data appearing and performing differently offline versus online. So my threshold question then becomes, if I have to repatriate data for preservation, Can I mirror the same level of informational payload and functionality offline as online?
Okay. Do you have any sense on how the communication providers who host these forms of communication feel about subpoenas and litigation holds? I mean, I've offered to have Verizon and these different providers on a show, and I've yet to get anyone to bite yet. But I know everyone asks that question, so.
Well, in the context of civil litigation, which is the ballpark in which I play most of the time, subpoenas are to cloud service providers what a pea shooter is to an elephant. I mean, cloud service providers pretty well ignore subpoena until and unless they get a court order requiring action. As to litigation holds, they tend to almost universally view that as the user's sole responsibility. And in my experience, they tend not to alter their business practices in response to subpoena, or certainly not in response to just a bare-faced demand for preservation. Now, I'm speaking here where they are not a litigant, but they are a third-party holder of information. And because of their economic clout, they've also succeeded, obviously, in getting certain legislation passed that insulates them in many respects from having to worry about liability from their cavalier attitude, like the Stored Communications Act and so forth. Now, obviously, I'm speaking in fairly broad generalizations, to be sure, but I think they are accurate nevertheless.
So, I'm an entrepreneur, and, I run a business, and I sometimes struggle with whether as lawyers and as e-discovery practitioners, we look at every technical problem and think that at some point someone's going to have to provide tools that make this process of getting ESI easier for lawsuits, or is that like the tail wagging the dog? I mean, do you think these communication providers are ever going to provide tools that make this easier, or are we just, a small little subset of the use of ESI that doesn't generate a lot of money for them, so why do they even think about it that much?
Well, I think from an economic standpoint, you're right. We in the legal profession look at ourselves as titans, and when you look at actually the software or the general business IT world, we're just a small and rather backward corner of that world. But happily, some of the various communications and service providers already do and are already starting to provide suites of solutions. I shouldn't use the word solutions in case my editor is listening, suites of responsive tools that will help make this easier. For example, cloud providers offer some of them virtualized implementations of Outlook version 2010. And 2010 has now matured to the point that it offers a variety of improved ways to implement what I'll call granular legal holds, more precise legal holds that are less able to be circumvented, and importantly, some tools to help guard against user shenanigans, to help put Humpty Dumpty back together again after the delete-a-thon on the day the subpoenas have arrived. So those who have virtualized Outlook tools in 2010 now have a variety of ways that they can do solid preservation, more consistent with the new rules, the rules that have been out for 6 years or so. Now, Google, for example, offers its corporate subscribers the ability to create container files holding user messages. So you can package user data that's in Google, and if you use their more enhanced tools, and they're not very expensive, and they're typical of what corporations who have offloaded the management of mail to Google Apps and so forth are using. So you can now have them email you, for example, a PST file, an Outlook-compatible file holding users' messaging. And even the social media providers are starting to dip their toes in the water of getting with the eDiscovery program. For whatever reason they're doing it, I'm sure it's not a response to eDiscovery, but we are the unlikely beneficiaries here in the legal profession.
Yeah, and I was just about to ask about this analysis changing with respect to social media. So you've opened up the gate. Let's talk about for example, Facebook's. Can we get our hands on Facebook pages easily today?
Well, increasingly, yes. I mean, social media is the perfect example of a new technology that's gotten far out in front of lawyers' ability to manage the information and its content in litigation. We are really strapped and really behind the curve where social media is concerned in the legal profession. You know, where for us, Carl, you and I, email is crucial, and it's a constant component of our day. It hardly exists for those who are now in high school and college, my children's age, for example. For them, social networking, especially Facebook, is the conduit by which they communicate almost exclusively. Their email is Facebook private messaging. So that raises the question, how do we access, search, and preserve social networking content? Now, fortunately, Facebook is leading the way in terms of simplified mechanisms to lock down the contents of a user's account. And do you want me to move on into that and talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
All right. Well, since last fall, Facebook has very quietly enabled a mechanism to replicate a user's Facebook account data, including the user's private messaging, offline. Now, within the account settings portion of a Facebook user's account, you'll find the option to, quote, download your information. And when you initiate the download process, Facebook will typically, within a few hours, email a link to the user's email address, and this allows you to download a zip or a compressed file that holds that user's account content. And that's going to include the user's wall postings, their photo postings, their private messaging, importantly. And when the user then decompresses this zip into a folder, the user or someone else can move around the data as if it were an online web page, but it's entirely offline. You don't need the net to look at the data. And you don't need the net, of course, then to search the data with tools capable of searching its text. Now, it's not perfect. But right now, it's the best we have, and it's a significant improvement over past approaches to Facebook, which have typically been, well, let's take a screenshot, or let's try to save the page code and reconstruct it offline.
Or friend someone who's on the other side.
Yeah, I know. I have real ethical problems with that. It's amazing to me how many lawyers view the use of pretense to friend somebody as okay, whereas if you were to try to even pick up the phone and put a call into that person represented by counsel and an opponent, your ethical alarm bells would go off. Let me say that friending someone to get access to their Facebook content is a surefire way to get yourself, if not in an ethical situation and disciplined by the bar, is going to pass almost no one's smell test when it's raised in front of a court or jury. Anyway, I digress.
Well, what about business tools? And you talked a little bit about some of the Google-type tools. Google Plus has now come out. I know we're and offering all sorts of suites of services, much like Microsoft Office. And it's not clearly not something that's going to go away. Does this keep you up at night as a forensics expert, or do you believe that the forensic tools are going to evolve over time to solve these types of challenges?
Well, I'm up most nights anyway, Carl. I love my work. And so.
But that's just the time zone. You're counting time zone differences as up at night.
Well, I never know. I have to check to find out what time zone I'm in most of the time, Carl. But seriously, if we define digital forensics as the analysis of storage media for evidence of prior usage for, say, the CSI sort of thing, the deleted data, the fragments of data, slack space, unallocated clusters, all the really cool aspects that have made up digital forensics for many years, then I'll tell you candidly that the cloud spells the end of digital forensics. And yes, we are all, in one sense, destined to be crying in our beers in terms of the disappearance of much of the information we used to find on local media. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen overnight, but it is definitely happening. We've seen it happening with the migration to webmail. Any forensic analyst who's being honest with you will tell you that our ability to find fragments of webmail surfing in 2011 is dramatically curtailed compared to what was 10 years ago, when we could literally recover most all of the traffic, and today it's catch as catch can to get that back. So yes, the answer is digital forensics will in many respects die with a migration to the cloud. But that doesn't mean that the techniques, and to some extent, to a lesser extent, the tools, will evolve. Because as things move to the cloud, what we're also finding is there's a much richer environment of information. It's harder in some ways to make data go away. The information is replicated. It takes forms where many people have collaborative access to the same data. I mean, very little of what it appears in a collaborative Facebook environment, for example, stays truly private. That information tends to be cross-tracked across tweets and posts of various kinds and reposts, et cetera, so that what we're finding is that information is much more broadly disseminated. The social networking phenomena has resulted in people bearing a lot more of their souls online. So, in fact, a lot of the things you used to have to ferret out, people are now posting on their Facebook pages, or their best friend is posting it on about it and tagging them in the photo where they're drunk or taking drugs or, you know, holding up a weapon or whatever it may be that they would have otherwise concealed. So the other thing about this is that not only are we seeing more information, but we're also seeing more information that we would have never expected to see. And by that I reference geolocation data.
Yeah.
Today, when you post a cell phone camera, and I, you know, the funny thing is when I give a speech, I often like to ask the lawyers in the audience, and lawyers have historically been very slow to adopt new technologies compared to others in other professions. And I'll say, how many of you today are carrying a device that, you know, is capable of taking a digital photograph, a digital video, and storing over a gigabyte of information? And virtually all of them today now raise their hands, of course. Keeping in mind that the vast majority of photos taken today are taken with cell phones, and that by the end of this year, by law, every cell phone sold in the United States must be GPS-enabled. For many of those photos, the location data, the geolocation data, very precise data within essentially a space of no more than about 30 feet, is being embedded into those photos by default. So when you share that photo or you post it online in many instances, the precise location where that data was taken is important. Now, let's put this in the context of a sad but recent series of news events. And surely we haven't in the press of all this infighting in Washington forgotten Representative Weiner, have we? And when Weiner shared his namesake photo, well, you know, that's a situation where if it was taken with a cell phone camera, and he, for example, had decided to deny it being a picture of his privates, well, then embedded geolocation data might be significant in showing that it was taken in his home, in his apartment, in the hotel room he occupied at a particular date and time. This is the kind of analysis, and I don't suggest that data was in those pictures, but this is the kind of richer data that is emerging in these cloud environments that will reinvent forensics. It won't be the same, but it's not going to go away.
Yeah, and then, I mean, that's a great example because you had one of his former college roommates, who's a comedian online, saying, I know Weiner from college, and that's not the Weiner I knew. But then you've got the geocaching disproving the comedian, so who I think was trying to help him out. It's interesting. So you're not feeling like the horse and buggy manufacturer, that there's a Darwinism present here and there's plenty of ways that forensic and technologists, I mean, Lord knows the legal community needs more people to understand technology. It's clearly a case of there are a lot more lawyers that don't understand this. So we shouldn't feel bad for forensics people. They just need to evolve.
Well, I think the same thing that affects lawyers, which is the legal profession in many ways, is facing a serious and crippling fallout because of lawyers' unwillingness and in some instances inability to evolve, to embrace not just technology, because lawyers will embrace technology that makes money for them. What they have failed to embrace is an understanding of information technology. Lawyers, you know, the currency of our world, litigators in particular, is information, and yet we have very stubbornly turned a blind eye to understanding most contemporary information systems, instead devoting our clients' resources, wasting them at trying to turn electronic information into something we used when we were children. And that's just irresponsible. But before I go down that all-too-familiar blind alley, let's say this. The good news for forensics is that as we migrate away from traditional forensics, static media forensics, analyzing the laptop, analyzing the desktop for forensic detritus, we have also seen an explosion, an amazing richness of information in the handheld devices that people have come to depend on. When I look at an iPhone and the nature of content, the keystroke logging of sorts, the location data that is stored, the inadvertent storage of every time you move between screens in an iPhone, the fact that the iPhone actually records the screen, puts it down in the media, just so you can get that lovely effect of the shrinking page. And I know that in the context, many of them are listening are saying, what the hell is he talking about with this thing? But if you're an iPhone user, you'll know that when you push the home button and you move between screens, you'll see this wonderful little effect of the screen shrinks to the middle, it zooms out, and then the new screen is there. Well, in order to create that effect, the iPhone has to take a screenshot of whatever appeared on the screen before the transition, and then it creates that effect. Well, you know, that picture, that screenshot, then technically it gets erased. But as we know, when you erase something, unless you overwrite it, it's not gone. And so all of those screenshots, every time you move between, say, your email and Foursquare or between Foursquare and your calendar, et cetera, every time you do that, you're taking a screenshot of what was on the screen and storing it. And you have literally thousands of these screenshots being stored down on the phone, forensically available, and extraordinarily revealing. So as we lose one resource, old traditional media analysis, we are finding just amazing volumes of revealing probative information that is turning up on our iPads, our iPhones, our Android devices, our online storage, our social networking, our geolocation networking, you name it. I mean, virtually all of our lives increasingly are being recorded almost second by second by our usage of digital media and tools, and that rich source of probative information, I call it evidence, it's not only not going away, but it is growing in its variety and its ubiquity.
Well, that's great to have your sense of where things are going on that optimistic note. I will just add that I replaced two broken droids for my daughters, so now they have the newest iPhones, and I'm still on an old BlackBerry, older BlackBerry, so, you know, but I'm in the legal community, so I'm not rushing forward.
You want to send me the broken droids, and I'll tell you what they've been up to?
There you go. I got to get an agreement signed, though. I don't know. My kids are good, or so I believe. You know.
I have no doubt.
Anyway, hey, Craig, this has been a great show. Always love having you on the program. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. Remember our show phonetically. It sounds out as Easy Bytes of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI Bytes you back. I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.